I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. As President Obama's right-hand man exits stage left, now former Chief of Staff Rahm Emanuel heading for Chicago to run for mayor, he and other administration officials may be entitled to some bragging rights, but they might not choose to take them up. Let's explain. We're talking about TARP, the Troubled Assets Relief Program, begun in the Bush administration. It bailed out banks and then the car industry, and it ends its run this Sunday. It was vilified by conservatives. Voting for it cost Republicans like Senator Bob Bennett of Utah their seats. But supporters say it saved the U.S. from another Great Depression. And now the Treasury Department says that taxpayers will lose relatively little money. And in fact, they could make some. Let's check in with Binyamin Applebaum, financial reporter for The New York Times. And Binyamin, we're opening The New York Times and seeing articles saying that, wow, you know, as unbelievable as it seems, this huge program may not be as much of a disaster, lose as much money as its critics say. But you say what? Take a more nuanced look at it?
Well, there's sort of two broader points that ought to be made about TARP. The first is that it is just a small piece of all of the money that the government ended up spending to bail out the financial industry and to save the economy. And so while this particular piece of spending may end up actually returning a modest profit to the government, on the whole, it's clear that we will have spent far more money than we recover on this vast project.
Sure, because the TARP is separate from the stimulus money, a whole separate section of money. But staying with TARP, boy, the view of it has been all over the place in the last couple of years. I mean, a lot of superlatives out there.
Yeah, you know, we've heard from some people that this is the program that prevented America from entering a second Great Depression, and from others that this is one of the most misguided pieces of government giveaways to large banks ever created. So there's been a remarkable dissonance in views on TARP, and this, frankly, won't settle that issue.
Right.
The fact that it's earned a little bit of money is not going to conciliate its critics any more than if it had lost a little bit of money.
Well, you've got financial economists like Brian Bethune of IHS Global Insight calling it a tremendous success. You've got people like Simon Johnson of MIT who said it was necessary, but it was a giveaway. But staying with the, you know, as it ends, this idea that, you know, it may not be the big money loser that people think it is. We know that some of this positive outlook came from news this week that the insurance giant AIG will be paying some bailout money back to the U.S.
Yes, this is a remarkable turnaround. The government invested a vast amount of money in AIG, and for a long time it was common wisdom that it would never see much of that money again. But the government now believes that it will be able to convince private investors essentially to take its place, that the government can convert its stake in AIG into common shares of stock, which can then be sold on the open market at a sufficiently high price for the government to get its money back, and in effect for private investors to assume the risk that the government has held until now. It would be a remarkable vote of confidence in that company whose prospects have looked fairly bleak for some time now.
Now, we remind ourselves, the original TARP package, on paper at least, was $700 billion. Now you have Treasury Secretary Tim Geithner reporting to President Obama that, in fact, that $700 billion program may only lose maybe about $50 billion. And as others are saying, well, actually, you know, in the end, it may actually make a little bit of a profit. But what, you know, what do you think about that? That phrase, it may only lose $50 billion.
Well, that is a remarkable phrase. That's something that we can only say. I think we've all grown a bit desensitized to large numbers. But it's important to say that, you know, part of why they may make a little bit of money is because they never spent most of the money. Only about $387 billion of that $700 billion was ever sent out into the world. And some of the things that they didn't spend on could have been quite expensive, such as helping homeowners avoid foreclosure, but also could have been very important. So some of the critics of TARP feel like the reason we're now in a position to say, hey, this wasn't so expensive after all, is because we didn't do many of the things that we said we were setting out to do.
Well, even if the administration has, you know, a little bit something to crow about, and in other words, it wasn't a total loss of billions of dollars, the Washington Post is reporting today, and I can only touch on this briefly, that, you know, they can't really crow about it because people just don't want to hear it out in the campaign trail.
And that's the politics of this are absolutely clear. The word TARP is poisonous. People hate the idea. They don't want to be reminded about it. And so while this success may yet someday resound to the administration's credit, in the short term, it's nothing that's going to win them political points.
Binyamin Applebaum, financial reporter for The New York Times, thank you.
My pleasure.
Well, it's Friday when we often take a break from the serious news, although don't tell our next guests that you don't consider typos that serious. In June of 2007, Dartmouth grad Jeff Deck was in a post-college funk. He wanted to do something to change the world, but what? He'd had good jobs, but nothing as earth-shaking as his Ivy League classmates. Well, as it turned out, one of his jobs, as copy editor for Rocks and Minerals magazine, gave Jeff Deck what he was looking for. A mission. It all began on a walk near his Cambridge, Massachusetts home. He came upon the no trespassing sign that had bothered him for years. Two S's in tress. But this time, he saw it with fresh eyes.
I stared at that no trespassing sign and I wondered, could I be the one? What if I were to step forward and do something? The glare from the extra S seemed to mock me. Sure, others before me had recognized that there was a problem afoot in modern English. Plenty of people had made much hay of ridiculing spelling and grammatical errors on late-night shows and in humor books and on websites weighted with snark. But who among them had ever bothered with actual corrective action? So far as I knew, not a soul. A lambent vision descended upon me, like the living wheels revealed unto Ezekiel. In it I saw myself armed with whiteout and black marker, waging a campaign of holy destruction on spelling and grammatical mistakes. The picture widened to describe not just my neighborhood, not just the Boston area or even the August span of the Bay State, but the entire nation.
And so began TEAL, or the Typo Eradication Advancement League. Armed with a website, correcting fluids and markers, Jeff set out on a cross-country trek with his friend Benjamin Herson to terminate typos. They write about it in the new book, The Great Typo Hunt, Two Friends Changing the World One Correction at a Time. And we're joined by Jeff Deck. Welcome.
Hello there. Thanks for having me on the program.
Also joining us is your co-author, Benjamin Herson. Benjamin, welcome to you as well.
Hi. Thank you.
And Jeff, start with you. Why can't there be two S's in the first trust? Because actually, later in the book, you explain how two consonants soften the vowel. So in that case, two S's would make a tret instead of trees passing.
Not all of English is phonetically logical, but I think it's around 86% of the language does follow pretty consistent phonetic rules, and we just have to memorize some of those special cases. And if people continually spell trespassing with two S's in the first part of it, then eventually I think we'll have to cede to the grammatical will of the people. But so far, I haven't really noticed any widespread movement to do that.
And by the way, just to continue that thought, Benjamin, help me with this. The two consonants softening the vowel, that is the rule, right?
That is the rule. The double consonant means the vowel preceding it is short.
Well, that's why now, because of your book, I was driving and I cannot see the word traveling without wanting those two L's there. And in all the public signs, there's one.
Well, here's the thing. The double consonant does signal that it's a short vowel, but the lack of double consonants doesn't automatically mean it's long.
Aye. So this is the kind of thing that you debated as you traveled, two L's, across country. And, Jeff, you realized early on that this wasn't something you wanted to do by yourself. You write, would Frodo ever have reached the heart of Mordor without the devoted companionship of Sam? That's where Benjamin comes in. Now, Benjamin, though, when Jeff first broached this to you, this idea of going cross-country and correcting things, you remembered a story that Jeff had written called The Missing R.
Yes, it was a story he had been working on just when we first became roommates right out of college. The star character of this fictional drama is an editor who tries to make things work for the better, but he doesn't have a way to really communicate with people around him and to really change things for the better. So what he does at the end of the story is he corrects a homeless man's sign.
What was the mistake?
Hungy, please help. And so he put in the R, which is the name of the story.
It was a fictional story, but it was actually based on a real sign that I had seen in Albany around that time.
So this sort of idea has been working its way through your noggin, you know, for a long time now in different forms in that fiction story. Let's talk about the trip. Tick through just a couple of the instances that you came across, where some of the signs were and what happened.
One just off the top of my head was in Chicago. There was a gigantic sign outside this store that was on Milwaukee Avenue, and the store was calling itself Milwaukee Furniture, but they had unfortunately misspelled the name of their own store. Milwaukee was, instead of having an A-U-K, it was U-A-K in the middle. The people inside when we told them about the mistake, did not really react with the drive to improve the impression that their store was giving that I had expected. They promised that they would pass it on to their manager, but it didn't really seem like anything was actually going to happen.
You know, I'm wondering, as I was reading, there were parts where I said, oh, Jeff, soften your approach, you know? Because didn't you find that it gets at the very heart of someone's sense of self-worth sometimes if you go in and say, you know, you don't know how to spell?
Yeah, I mean, to some extent, we are our text, and so it's only a natural human reaction for someone to get defensive when somebody points out their mistake. We tried to be sensitive to the fact that people would get defensive and approach them as courteously as possible and emphasize the fact that we were only going after the mistakes themselves and not the people who made them.
We really wanted to shift from just correcting single errors that we found to asking everybody to take a second look, because to err is human, and we're all going to have typos. So if we could just take that extra moment to take a second look at what we've written, we can catch a lot of them. Or just ask somebody, hey, can you take a look at this?
Right. Well, and some people loved it. You spot a big marquee outside the Pacific Superstore in South Carolina advertising sweats, S-W-E-A-T-T-S, and the young sales girl comes out and looks at it and says, oh, I thought when you shorten sweat shirts, there are two T's. And her manager was happy to change it.
He was. His only condition was that I hold the ladder for him as he climbed up to correct it on the sign. It was just great to be able to hold the ladder for that guy.
Benjamin, give us another example that did warm your heart. There was one sign you thought was going to be impossible to correct. I think it was the it apostrophe S that shouldn't have had an apostrophe.
Yes. This is one of my favorite typo corrections of all. Benton Shoe, now in its 16th year, and there's an apostrophe in it. We have an apostrophe when it's a contraction. It's, that's a possessive pronoun, doesn't need an apostrophe. And people get thrown because possessives need apostrophes. That's the rule, but pronouns are the exception.
Oh, yeah, yeah, my head's exploding. In other words, if it's it is, it needs...
It needs that
apostrophe. And if it's as in possession...
Its 16th year doesn't need it.
Right.
So there was an apostrophe that didn't belong, but it had been written on this whiteboard for so long that it wouldn't wipe off. So the woman came out and she grabbed a marker and she turned it into a little star and she put a couple more stars and it made it look like there were fireworks on the sign. So she really creatively fixed that typo and made the sign even better.
Benjamin Herson, a co-author with Jeff Deck of The Great Typo Hunt. Jeff and Ben had a huge discussion about what to do with a sign for Davy Jones' locker. S apostrophe or apostrophe S? Well, that takes them to the Chicago Manual of Style, which makes apostrophe exceptions for biblical names like Jesus. Of course, Davy Jones isn't Jesus. Oy. What about you? Do you have favorite typos? Tell us about them at our website, hereandnow.org. Back in 1 minute, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide. On the web at mathworks.com.
Welcome back. We're talking typos with 20-somethings Jeff Deck and Benjamin Herson. In their new book, they write about their cross-country journey as founding members of the Typo Eradication Advancement League, their mission to correct errors on signs. And Jeff Deck, as you and Benjamin were doing this, you began to have misgivings because most of the signs you were correcting were in small, independently owned businesses, because big corporate chains, they have proofreaders. And you began to realize that maybe those typos were giving these small local places their unique charm.
I did have to ask myself, am I doing the right thing? Am I just destroying the character of these independent businesses by homogenizing their language? But I think it's kind of condescending to imply that one's character is contained entirely in their mistakes.
Well, and you also say that this is one of the wedges that are driven in a class war. You know, people can turn their nose up at people who have spelling mistakes, and you wanted to, you know, sort of level the playing field a little more.
Well, yeah, and that's one of the major problems with typos that are, let's say, in some small storefront window, is that they're not only clouding and impeding the communication itself of whatever message they're trying to convey, but they're distorting the impression that the store gives off. it says something, whether it's fair or not, about this particular store's attention to detail.
So you changed pudding, P-U-D-I-N-G, on a blackboard to pudding, and you changed bracklets to bracelets?
No, that lady was a tough nut to crack.
That's right. That's right. She wouldn't let you do that. But that's where you also remind us of the thing that teachers used to say to us. It's the silent E that makes the vowel say its name.
Right. The silent E indicates the long vowel sound.
Right. So bracklets does need that E, so you can
it
hear bracelets.
Does.
But she wouldn't let you do that. And all this time you're keeping a website. And this is where you discovered that there are different camps, grammar hawks and grammar hippies. Jeff.
You might also hear it referred to as prescriptivism versus descriptivism. And we were calling the prescriptivists the grammar hawks, the ones who were very hard-line about language and believe that, for example, that English has a pure form and that pure form needs to be defended and don't really have a lot of room for things like slang. And the other polar end of the spectrum is the descriptivist, or the grammar hippie, which argues that language is ever-evolving, and so to go after typos is not just a hopeless enterprise, but is actively against the tide of language change. We actually started off towards different ends of the spectrum. I guess I was more naturally towards the end of the grammar hawk, not on the full extreme of that end. Benjamin started off the quest as a little more of a grammar hippie himself, but we eventually tried to steer the league into basically the reasonable middle between the two extremes.
Then you come to the Grand Canyon. Now, a lot of people know you really don't want to take markers and whiteout into a national park, but apparently you didn't. What happened in the Grand Canyon? What did you find?
We ended up in this watchtower on the south rim of the Grand Canyon, and we came across a sign that was pretty innocuous looking. It was just some yellow letters that were scrawled on black fiberboard.
Oh, boy.
And they had a misplaced apostrophe in the word women's. The apostrophe, instead of coming before the S, came after the S.
Is that apostrophe again? Yes.
Yeah, definitely. And there was a comma that was missing from a list, so two items in the list were running together. And so we didn't think it would be a big deal to just move that apostrophe and add that comma in there.
We thought it was just another chalkboard sign. We should have realized in that moment that we tried to smudge away the chalk apostrophe that it was not what it appeared.
We only realized later on that the sign had been created about 70 years ago and was considered by the Park Service to have historic and aesthetic value. So after our trip was over, the Park Service summoned us to federal court. We're ordered to pay $3,000 in restitution, and we were also banned from all national parks for a year. That was when we really realized that we should have had a firm policy all along of always asking permission before fixing a typo, and we definitely have that policy in place now.
Yeah. Were you satisfied with your mission, with this kind of two superheroes and friends, there were others, out to do what? To make America beautiful on signs. Were you satisfied with what you did?
Well, I mean, it was a great journey. We had a lot of great conversations with people, and we did track down and fix a lot of typos.
How many?
We found a total of about 437 typos, and of those, we corrected about 236, so a little over half.
Well, and this program and your boosterism comes at a time, as you well know, when kids are texting. They're not making common spelling mistakes. They're not even bothering. You know, thanks is T-N-A-X, and I don't even know what it is. And you know, and then I'm just open, and here's you two talking to each other. Benjamin, you've called Jeff at night. You've had some Hosanna. And you say, check it. There are two main categories of spelling junctions, plus junctions and change junctions. To plus morrow equals tomorrow. That's a plus junction. Copy times ed equals copied. That's a change junction. So it goes from C-O-P-Y to C-O-P-I-E-D. I'm reading this and I'm thinking, these are guys who call each other late at night to have that kind of conversation. And people might say to you, you know, you're kind of a dying breed. And
I think it can be kind of an unfair stereotype to say that the only interest in good spelling and grammar is restricted to older generations. We've definitely heard from and talked with a lot of people you know, our age and a lot younger who are very excited about this kind of thing. And it's been great.
In fact, if I can go one further.
Please do.
I think typos are a form of pollution. Much like pollution, you're seeing more of it today because there's a sort of general apathy, one of those tragedy of the commons type things, where it's just piled up more and it's more than we think we can do about it. But that you can get rid of pollution if everybody makes a concerted effort, and you can get rid of typos the same way.
That's Benjamin Herson with Jeff Deck. He co-authored The Great Typo Hunt, Two Friends Changing the World, One Correction at a Time. We'll direct you to their website at hereandnow.org. Jeff and Benjamin, thanks.
Well, thank you so much.
The U.S. has had a car culture, of course, for decades, but in China, it's just beginning to flower. China is now the world's largest market for car manufacturers, with expected sales of more than 10 million vehicles this year. And the dramatic increase in car ownership has led to a boom across China of driving clubs. In Beijing alone, there are believed to be hundreds of them, with thousands of drivers hitting the highways every weekend. They say the clubs can help foster a sense of community and of society where people can sometimes feel isolated. The BBC's Martin Patience joined a car club for a day to find out why they're so popular.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Morning. What's your name?
My name is Donghong.
Donghong. And I see you've got lots of radios on the top of your car. You're the coordinator.
Yes.
It's 7:30 in the morning. We're just in the outskirts of Beijing. Now, we're at the rallying point for the Chengxin Tinsha Car Club. Now, that literally means the car club that goes around the world. We're not planning to travel that far today. Hopefully, we're going to drive a couple of hours out into the countryside, and we're hoping to get going in a few minutes or so. We're in a car with Miss Song and Miss Jiang, who've kindly agreed to take us. Now, the car club is travelling in convoy. Most of the vehicles are small cars, the kind of Chinese equivalent of minis. And Miss Song, how does it feel to be out on the road?
My heart feels like it's flying. It makes me so happy to be out driving with friends.
And what kind of freedom, then, does the car give you that you haven't had in the past?
It's a great way to meet people, and it means you can escape from the city.
We've driven for 2 hours, and now we've arrived in a village. All the cars are parked up beside a local farmhouse, which is made of red brick, and then just behind it is a spectacular mountain covered in green trees. And then just to my right is an enormous pile of hazelnuts. The plan is to go for a walk, and then hopefully we'll have a bite to eat. We spent the last 20 minutes climbing through a gorge, and that's one of the reasons for these car clubs. It's to get out and enjoy the countryside. And I'm just with Fan, who's one of the drivers. Fan, what brought you along today? Why did you come?
Things are different now. People in their 20s do not communicate like they did in the past. Our parents lived in houses with courtyards, and everyone knew each other, and everyone talked to each other. But now we live in high-rise buildings, and it can be very isolating. The car club is great for creating a sense of community.
During lunch, I asked Dong Hong, the club coordinator, what the popularity of these car clubs said about China. He tells me that the clubs reflect an attitude change in Chinese drivers. In the past, cars were simply for practical purposes. But now, he says, cars are seen as a way to enjoy life. Well, this trip appears to be coming to an end. We've just finished a lovely lunch, and now we're waiting to take the group photograph which will serve as a souvenir for the day out. Now, these car clubs are becoming increasingly popular across China, and with the number of cars in Beijing set to double in the next 5 years, these car clubs will become even more popular, and that will mean even more days out.
That report from the BBC's Martin Patience in China. Well, coming up, how does a California hospital chain charge 30 to 70% more for typical procedures than its competitors do? We'll ask them in 30 seconds, here and now. McDonald's today denied reports that it plans to drop health care coverage for 30,000 part-time employees. Yesterday, the Wall Street Journal reported that the fast food chain did plan to drop those employees unless it got a waiver from some provisions in the new health care reform law. And McDonald's and the Obama administration say they are working together to make sure those employees don't lose their coverage. Well, while the new law's requirements have been making headlines, there's another debate brewing over the role of big hospital chains. We recently spoke with Bloomberg Businessweek about their investigation into how one conglomerate, Sutter Health in Northern California, can charge 40 to 70% more than its competitors because it's bought up so many hospitals in the region. No insurance company would dare try to negotiate prices down for fear of losing Sutter's business. Well, today, a response from Sutter Health. Bob Reed is Senior Vice President and Chief Financial Officer. Welcome.
Thank you, Robin.
And Business Week, as you know, gave several examples of this price disparity. An MRI knee scan at Sutter Davis Hospital was about $1,200. At Radiological Associates of Sacramento, it was far less, $700. At Sutter's Palo Alto Medical Foundation, it was nearly $6,000 to deliver a baby. At a solo practitioner in Mountain View, right there a couple miles away, it was just $2,000. So why is there the cost disparity?
A hospital has to be available 24/7. All of the backup facilities, physicians, resources have to be on call. The hospital is also providing charity care and, more importantly, care to the Medicaid population, which is subsidized through the charges we charge to the commercially insured population, which is very different from a retail clinic that doesn't have all that same infrastructure cost.
But people still say that doesn't explain the huge disparity. Immunizations, for instance, $85 at a Sutter facility, $10, $16 elsewhere. Business Week also reported that in a California state antitrust suit in 1999, internal Sutter documents revealed that it was Sutter's strategy to make itself indispensable to insurance plans, you know, buying up, consolidating with other hospitals, and then therefore being able to raise prices. Are you saying that that's not true, that that's not something Sutter also hopes to do in addition to covering extra expenses a hospital has, you know, just being able to raise the prices because you can?
Raising our prices is not the intent. You know, healthcare is an order of magnitude more complex than I think the surface level analysis that we're talking about. And it runs to the enormous unfunded mandates, other requirements that are put upon the healthcare providers. Our organization, we think, is acting responsibly in terms of meeting all of the challenges that are put forward, charity care, access. So our strategy has been one to work on long-term reducing the cost of care or making it a more affordable product. Currently, it's not designed as a retail one-off shopping for an item. It's really designed more on a wholesale basis around an insured product.
Well, let's stay with that for a second. Why not then go with global payments? Global payments are when facilities are given a chunk of money and told, this is what we estimate that it would cost to treat diabetes. Go treat this person's diabetes with this chunk of money, as opposed to the per unit basis, which is how you charge. And critics of that system say that it incentivizes facilities like yours to then do so many more tests because you're going to get paid for each one.
Your observation is exactly correct, and that's exactly what Sutter Health has been trying to do. We've been on a journey for 20 years trying to break down the silos and isolated, uncoordinated events of care and try to bring it into a more bundled, organized delivery system. So your observation is exactly correct, and we absolutely support that, and that's the work that we've been doing and trying to put together.
And what's stopping you from doing it?
Everything that we do is heavily regulated. What the physicians are allowed to do, heavily regulated. What the hospitals are allowed to do, heavily regulated. Most people are not even aware there's a law against the corporate practice of medicine.
Meaning what?
Meaning that organizations do not employ physicians, at least in California, to provide care. So often there's a basic misunderstanding, if you will, of how the entire industry is organized and what the constraints are.
Well, meanwhile, the Cleveland Clinic does the global payment, so they've managed to be able to do this. But in the interim, why not then change the way at least consumers can find out about these single payments for each treatment? Business Week also says you don't allow insurance companies to disclose how much they pay you for different procedures. Wouldn't it be valuable for a patient to be able to look at how much an insurance company was paying Sutter and be able to compare that with a clinic, and if it's $1,000 less, save the insurance company that money and go to the clinic?
We support transparency. So we've got nothing against being transparent. We believe it's important.
Except that you've asked insurance companies not to be transparent.
Again, let's go back and talk about the complexities that are put in place by the Federal Trade Commission and the ability to share prices, or how does negotiated prices become, what is the discovery process on the pricing, and is it legal? And therein lies a lot of caution or a lot of restrictions in terms of what our ability to do and behave is.
So you're saying that the government somehow prohibits you from letting insurance companies know, because according to Business Week, insurance companies said that in particular, you asked that, you being Sutter, asked that these not be made available, but others are.
We've spent a lot of time talking about how do we make things more transparent and more available, but not run afoul of FTC antitrust issues.
A couple last questions. Sutter Health is a nonprofit, but it makes a profit of about 5%, and according to Business Week, that's 75% greater than the average for hospitals across the country. Wouldn't it make sense to turn some of that profit back into the hospitals and drive down some of these high costs?
Well, again, this is where I think you're missing the bigger story. The bigger story is half the hospitals out there are losing money. I make no apologies for the 5% margin. I don't understand how anybody can run a healthcare system without a 5% margin. I'll tell you, the reason we're successful is because we're able to competently field a team that can go toe-to-toe with the insurance companies. And a small, single hospital just can't do it. It's too complicated. There's too big. Not that they're not as intelligent. It's just that you can't apply your skill set to such a wide variety of problems.
Bob Reed, Sutter Health Senior Vice President and Chief Financial Officer. Bob, thank you.
Robin, thank you.
Support for Here and Now comes in part from the Skoll Foundation, supporting social entrepreneurs around the world, uncommon heroes dedicated to the common good. Learn more at skoll.org.
Welcome back. That's The Visitor by the Portugal Quartet. Now visitors to this country, the British instrumental group on its first U.S. tour to promote their new release, Isla. Discovered playing the streets of London just a few short years ago, the ensemble, all in their early 20s, quickly earned critical acclaim, and in 2008, a nomination for England's Mercury Prize. That's the top award for albums. They were nominated for their debut, Knee Deep in the North Sea. joining us from NPR Studios in New York, two members of the Portico Quartet, saxophonist Jack Wiley. Jack, welcome.
Hi, how you doing?
I'm good. And double bassist Milo Fitzpatrick. Milo, hi to you as well.
Hi.
And we know Duncan Bellamy is at home, probably nursing his hands. He's the drummer. And Nick Mulvey is apparently nursing a cold. But he plays something that really distinguishes the quartet. Critics say you can't talk about the Portico Quartet without talking about the... Milo, you say it. What is it?
It's called a hang.
Hang. And what hang. Is it? Describe it.
The hang is an unusual steel instrument. Try and imagine two kind of kitchen woks welded together. But it's a little bit like a steel drum from Tobago in Trinidad mixed in with ideas of the gamelan from Indonesia. Mm. And you get this kind of strange, kind of gongy metallic instrument.
Give us a taste of it. I know you have one there.
Sure, yeah.
Find it.
Duncan and Nick were at a WOMAD festival. It's World of Music and Dance Festival in England, and they just came across this kind of little stall selling weird kind of instruments from around the world, and they heard this and they just thought, you know, we got to get one of those. And then soon Nick followed and got another one in a sympathetic key. And yeah, kind of just started from there.
Let's hear how you use it. Well, for instance, in the introduction to Papers, Scissors and Stone. Hearing it there in the sort of the higher notes, da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da, is that it?
Yeah, it kind of sits in the middle kind of like register, and it works kind of well with the other instruments in the band, with the sax being very high and the bass very low, so the hang sits very comfortably in the middle and fills out the sound.
Wow. Well, what do you think it does for your sound?
It's Jack here. Yeah. I suppose it adds something that a lot of other bands don't have. I mean, it's a very unusual sound that people haven't heard before, really. It was only invented in the year 2000.
Oh, by the way, where? Where did it come from?
It's actually a Swiss instrument, mm-hmm. but as Milo was saying, the influences of it are ancient.
It's so dreamy.
Yeah, I mean, with any kind of music, it's, you know, so subjective of what it makes you feel. So you say dreamy, and other people say some tracks are very kind of intense and almost kind of dreading, you know, like some Radiohead tracks or something like this.
Well, you mentioned a Radiohead. Let's listen to a track that's more Radiohead-y right here. Milos, we understand you guys studied jazz, classical, had influences like Miles, Wayne Shorter. Name some others.
I mean, it kind of goes beyond the jazz realm into classical, such as Steve Reich and Philip Glass, and then also like electronica music. So yeah, it's quite a wide variety.
Well, let's hear some of that Steve Reich influence. He's the minimalist composer, and your hang drum player Nick Mulvey said that for his 15th birthday, his mother got him a copy of Reich's Music for 18 Musicians.
Yeah.
So let's hear a little of that influence in the title track, Ira. We certainly hear that there. How'd that happen? Because you're in your 20s. And I'm not, you know, assigning, you know, all 20-year-olds to, you know, pop radio. But how did that happen, that these are your influences?
I don't know, really. I suppose you just... I mean, one of the things these days is you've got platforms like Spotify, like internet platforms, where you can basically listen to anything. And, you know, it's just opened up so much music for us. And then Nick as well studied ethnomusicology, which is the study of world music, essentially. And he studied gamelan as well.
Ah.
And that drew really nicely in with the hang drum.
Well, that's Jack Wiley, the saxophonist, and we've also been speaking with Milo Fitzpatrick, the double bass player. For the Portico Quartet, they also play the hang. It's sort of like two woks fused together. Can we just hear a little more of the hang? The hang? Get the hang
sure.
of the hang? It's just a great sound. Well, for more, you can go to hearnow.org, and we're going to go out with, is it Subo's Mental Meltdown?
Yeah, yeah, that's the one.
Is there a story there?
Do you know Suzanne Boyle?
Yeah, from X Factor.
From X Factor.
Oh. Is this Susan Boyle, the singer, or the who
yeah,
had sudden
yeah.
stardom?
Yeah. yeah.
And are you, like, scoring her unbelievable rise to fame?
It's amazing. We've been following her from the start. And, you know, she's also a big influence on our music. So, you
how
know,
so?
Versus.
How so?
You know, it's just like her passion and her belief that, you know, she could, like, make it. It was something that we really aspire towards, so.
Well, it's a bit of a joke. It's not like...
Well,
it's not
is
a joke,
it?
Jack.
Well, is
no,
it?
It's not a joke. It is serious. I don't know. For me, it is.
You guys better straighten this out before you get back on the stage. Jack, Milo, thank you and good luck.
Thanks.
Great. Thanks for having us.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service and PRI. Our producers include Lynn Menegon, Hitesh Hati, Kevin Sullivan, Emiko Tamagawa, and Alex Ashlock. Our interns are Megan Kane and Anna Miller. Our technical director, Doug Sugertz. Chris Ballman is the managing editor. The senior producer of Here and Now is Kathleen McKenna. I'm Robin Young. Have a great weekend, and please join us again, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.